You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 28th of August 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show...
The situation in the east of Ukraine substantially deteriorated. Russia has sent a number of armored personal vehicles, tanks, and troops.
Who are probably not there on holiday. Zania Wickett from Chatham House and Oscar Guardiola Rivera from Birkbeck University will talk us through the continuing crises in Ukraine and Iraq and some mercifully lower key upheavals in South America. Later in the programme, we'll look at the life and legacy of the Iranian poet Simon Bebahani, who died last week. Plus, we'll hear from our correspondent in Brussels and review the week's new books, among them the latest from Martin Amis. That's Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, coming up right now. An action-packed 58 and a half minutes ahead of us as ever, but ahead of all that, Bill Bingham has the latest world news.
Monocle 24 News. Ukrainian officials say two columns of Russian tanks and military vehicles have fired at a border post before entering the southeast of the country. It's reported the tanks entered an area of the eastern Donetsk region seized by the separatists for the first time earlier this week. Russia denies its forces have crossed Ukraine's border. NATO says it's detected a significant increase in the number of Russian arms being supplied to the rebels over the past 2 weeks. At least 2,100 people have been killed in 4 months of fighting in the region. The UN Security Council is to hold an emergency meeting in New York on Thursday at 1800 GMT to discuss the crisis. UN Security Council members have been told life for Syria's civilians over the past few months has grown worse. Figures quoted by the UN Office for Humanitarian Affairs show more than 191,000 people have been killed between the onset of the conflict in spring 2011 and April 2014. It's believed the real death toll is much higher. The report comes a day after another UN report accused Islamic State insurgents in the conflict of committing war crimes and said there was evidence Damascus had used chlorine gas on its enemies. Assistant Secretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, Kyung-Hwa Kang, warned the Council there's no sign of a let-up.
In the face of total impunity, grave human rights violations have become the norm in Syria. Parties to the conflict are oblivious of their obligations to protect civilians and abide by international humanitarian law, as they continue to commit terrible crimes against civilians, young and old, women and men. The perpetrators must be held accountable. The impunity must end.
The World Health Organization says the deadly Ebola outbreak in West Africa could infect more than 20,000 people before it's brought under control. WHO says the number of cases could already be 4 times higher than the 3,000 currently registered. It's also called on airlines to resume vital flights across the region, saying travel bans are threatening efforts to beat the epidemic. So far, 1,552 people in Liberia, Sierra Leone, Guinea and Nigeria have died. The International Monetary Fund is warning the outbreak of Ebola, the worst ever, is likely to lead to reduced employment, increased poverty, and food insecurity among vulnerable groups in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. IMF spokesman Jerry Rice told reporters what action the IMF can take.
All three of these countries have an on-track extended credit facility program with the IMF. Again, we're actively working with all three countries to prepare a preliminary economic assessment of the impact of the Ebola crisis and additional financing support that may be required.
UN officials say 43 of their peacekeepers are being held by an armed group in the Syrian Golan Heights. The UN Disengagement Observer Force personnel were detained near Quneitra during fighting between Syrian rebels and government forces. Another 81 UNDOF peacekeepers are being restricted in the region. The announcements come a day after rebels took control of a crossing into the Israeli-occupied Golan after a long battle. Malaysia and Australia are to share the cost of the latest efforts to find the remains of the missing Malaysia Airlines flight MH370. The Boeing 777 disappeared on March the 8th, carrying 239 passengers and crew shortly after taking off from the Malaysian capital of Kuala Lumpur, bound for Beijing. Despite intensive searches, no trace of the aircraft has been found. In a landmark initiative to help the poor, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi has launched a plan to provide a bank account for every household. Nearly 40% of Indians have little access to financial services and are often at the mercy of moneylenders charging huge interest rates. Mr. Modi's government aims to provide bank accounts to 75 million households by 2018 and to have two account holders per household. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Vanuit Londen. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
位于伦敦, 这是 Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House, live from Midori House. The time here in London is 18.06. It's 13.06 in New York. Well, joining me now with their take on today's news, I have here in the studio Xenia Wickett, director of the US program at Chatham House, and Oscar Guardiola Rivera, senior lecturer in law at Birkbeck University, both of those here in London. Welcome to the program, both of you. We will start tonight with Ukraine. If Moscow is to be believed, the country is currently benefiting from a huge tourist boom created by a sudden influx of holidaying Russian soldiers. To everybody else, it looks rather more like Russia is invading Ukraine, at least insofar as it already wasn't. Oscar, I'll ask you first. NATO now says well over 1,000 Russian troops are in Ukraine. How many before you actually start calling it an invasion of Ukraine by Russia?
Well, they were there before. I mean, they have always been there. There is no reason for... the point is not whether it is an invasion anymore. The point is how we solve this thing before it gets any worse, if it can get any worse. And of course, the solution is for the United States and Russia to come to an agreement. We need that also because of what's happening in the Middle East. But clearly, now we are in a situation in which the only realistic possibilities involve engaging in serious conversations in which all sides are going to lose.
Xenia, Moscow, rather charmingly, is still pretending to have absolutely nothing at all to do with any of this. Why are they bothering with that?
Because it allows them to get away with an awful lot.
Nobody believes it.
But
doesn't matter.
But here's the issue: the West, and I differ with Oscar in this. I don't think it's about U.S. and Russia coming to an agreement. I actually think it's much more about Europe and Russia coming to an agreement, with the U.S. being part of that, because the links between Europe and Russia, whether it's energy and economic, are so much greater than they are with the United States. But it serves every, to some extent, the Russians aren't coming out and acknowledging it because they want to get away with as much dirty business as they can before they get called on it. The West isn't coming out and acknowledging it because actually if the West came out and acknowledged it, then the West might have to take a more firm action, which it doesn't actually want to do particularly. So you've kind of got everybody to some extent trying to, well, at least the West trying to actually alleviate the tensions and find a kind of face-saving way for Putin to
Great.
To kind of lower tensions. Putin, on the other hand, he loses if Ukraine stabilizes. If he doesn't win this, then he's got all sorts of domestic problems. So he can't be seen to lose.
God, but
the
wait,
West
wait
can't
there.
Lose.
Wait there. I mean, all sides have to lose here because it's not just a matter of punishing Putin. Of course, we would all want to punish him, and he deserves punishment, no question about it. But one of the reasons why he can get away with so much is because Europe cannot do much more. Let us be very clear about that. We cannot ask for NATO to be rolled to the Kremlin's door. And that if that is not going to happen, then we need a serious engagement. Europe will get engaged if the United States get engaged. And what we need now is it's going to be bad for everyone, not what we want to. It's very possible that by the end of this, part of Crimea will remain in Russia's hands.
Crimea is going to remain in Russia's hands.
And then, of course, Europe is going to also acknowledge that, trying to bring Ukraine into its fold wasn't perhaps as a good idea.
I agree that everybody has to lose, but everybody has to be seen to win. This is actually not so dissimilar from the events in the Middle East over the last couple of days, where both Hamas and the Israelis said, yes, we won, look at what we achieved, when actually both sides to the outside world clearly appear to have lost.
Nothing.
It's exactly the same, in some respects, it's the same. Both sides have to appear to win, because they have to appear, Putin has to appear strong, because otherwise he has all sorts of domestic challenges ahead. And the West has to appear strong, because they have to actually show deterrence is effective. But in the end, you're right, to some extent, both of them are going to lose. Ukraine definitely loses Crimea. We can't afford to let Russia win this kind of an action, but equally the West is going to be propping up economically Ukraine for years.
Yeah,
I think on that happy note, we should acknowledge that we are not going to be stuck for opportunities to revisit Ukraine. This is not something that's going anywhere in a hurry. We'll move along to the Middle East, which is continuing to be the Middle East. The United States, having been reluctantly drawn back into a Middle Eastern country it didn't want to return to, is now considering getting involved in a Middle Eastern country it has been desperate to keep out of, which is to say that President Obama is reported to be considering expanding airstrikes against Islamic State targets into Syria. Zainia, I'll ask you first. This is inevitable, isn't it? If you're serious about taking on the Islamic State, you have to hit them in Syria, which is where they're based.
So the US and the West more broadly has to actually decide what its objective is. And if it truly believes, as Defense Secretary Hagel has suggested or stated, as Secretary Kerry has stated, that there is that ISIS is a clear and present danger to the United
John
States.
John Kerry indeed has said they must be destroyed.
Exactly. If that is true, then the only way of doing that is to actually act in Syria as well as in Iraq. But it's also, it's to act in Syria and in Iraq. But it's also, you actually need to have some forces on the ground. There may not be American forces on the ground, but you have to have some forces on the ground. You cannot do this just by the air. So what the US needs to decide, what Obama needs to decide, is what exactly is the goal here? Is it creating a democracy? Is it destroying ISIS? What actually is the is it just pushing it back so it's weak, it can't act against the United States, and then come up with a strategy? And the fear that many people have at the moment is there's almost a need to act based on some of the events that have taken place over the last few weeks, and therefore the US is acting without that strategy,
goal. I had a nightmare last night with Hegel, the US Secretary of Defense, and Hegel, the German philosopher, having a discussion, and Talal Assad was laughing his socks off on the background. Part of the problem here is, number one, the legal case has not been made by the United States. We were condemning Russia for infringing upon international law and going into Ukraine. Well, the U.S. is going to have to persuade us that there is a legal case to enter Syria, and that is very, very difficult. On the one hand. On the other hand, what is it? Something like 50 to 58% of Americans disapprove of Obama's foreign policy, but 61% of Americans do not want him to get involved in Syria. They do not want further involvement in Syria.
On that point, it strikes me that, and I'd be interested to know what you both think of this, that Barack Obama has two very difficult sells to make. One, in taking America to war in yet another Middle Eastern country, which is the last thing the American public want, and the other, to do that in a way that doesn't make it look like the US Air Force is acting as air cover for President Assad.
So, I think on the first one, is you're absolutely right. essentially, and just kind of picking up on Oscar's point, there has to be a legal basis for this. There absolutely has to be a legal basis for this, because without a legal basis, you're setting up or you're reinforcing precedents that America spends an awful lot of time telling other governments that they cannot do. That hasn't been clear. But again, going back to Obama isn't talking about going to war in Syria or against
Not
Syria.
Yet.
There is absolutely no way, I think, under any
circumstances,
but then there's no way America is going to go to war in Syria or against the Syrian government. Whether America will do targeted airstrikes is a different matter. That, I think, is quite possible. And it will do it in partnership with other countries. America isn't going to go in alone. They're going to do it in partnership with other countries in the region. If they can, they'll probably try and do it in partnership with NATO. If they could, they'd try and do it in partnership with the UN. But there has to be a legal basis. But do not think of this being American war against another American war in the Middle East, because it will absolutely not play out that way.
But how many times has it been demonstrated that you can't defeat not even a non-state insurgency like the Islamic State just from the air? If you're serious, as John Kerry says, that these people must be destroyed, you're going to need to go and get them, aren't you?
Well, I hope they're also serious about their finances. I mean, we keep hearing day after day, oh, these guys are very well funded. By whom? I think we all know the answer. You know, a couple of states around the area. States which the United States could put a lot more pressure on. So that has to be, that has to come first. Then, of course, we need the legal case, and that's very difficult. It will have to go through the United Nations. Anyhow, in the end, another mess in what is still the Middle East for how long?
With that, we will take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Miller, joined by Xenia Wickett and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. When we return, we'll be looking at the Americas, North and South.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist, right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House. Still with me is Xenia Wickett and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. We'll look now at the United States. The country's attitude to guns is obviously bewildering to most outside observers, but one would have hoped that even the most foam-flecked, fire-breathing, from-my-cold-dead-hands NRA headbanger could have conceded the unwisdom of allowing a 9-year-old to play with an automatic weapon capable of firing 10 rounds a second. However, exactly such a scenario at a Las Vegas shooting range called Bullets and Burgers earlier this week resulted in the death of an instructor, the unimaginable traumatizing of some poor kid, and reignition of the gun control debate again. Xenia, I'll ask you first the obvious, if somewhat possibly absurd question. Why is a 9-year-old firing an Uzi?
You know what? It's a brilliant question. There is a... you look at the numbers. There's a fundamental... I mean, this is one of the areas where... this goes back to the American Constitution and the right to bear arms. And that's... concept is held so strongly in American history that you just can't play with it. And you've seen, you know, whether it's a 9-year-old at a shooting range losing control of an Uzi, or it's a it's people who have mental problems. We know they have mental problems getting hold of vast numbers of guns, including guns like this that can fire huge numbers of bullets in a very short period of time, shooting congressmen and women, going into schools, primary schools, and shooting. I mean, again and again and again. And the most absurd logic takes place in the United States, which those who believe that Americans should hold guns, the NRA and others, say, well, we can only be safe if everybody's holding guns. So actually, we should now arm all of the teachers. And that's the way to stop thing happening.
And all the school kids, apparently.
And all the school kids, apparently. And it just, to anybody who sits outside the United States, the logic is just lacking, including myself.
The Second Amendment does contain some reference, I'm sure, to a well-regulated militia. This would appear to fall outside that. Oscar, the tone of the debate in the US, there hasn't been, again, the debate has come up again, but the tone of the debate in America is as bizarre as the subject. In America, from what I've read, it's mostly been framed around the fact, well, of course, people saying a 9-year-old shouldn't be firing a fully automatic weapon, they should just be firing single shots at that age, and people complaining that the instructor was incorrectly positioned. This is never going to change, is it, in America?
Of course it's not going to change, because it's nonsense. mind you, the Second Amendment had nothing to do with this. The Second Amendment's point was that citizens had the right to defend themselves from a centralized army. It was a revolutionary amendment, not this nonsense defended by the National Rifle Association and the late Charlton Heston. This idea that a kid, you know, I can see already a National Rifle Association spokesperson telling us that actually the younger kids get familiar with weapons, the safer they will be. I bet you that tomorrow somebody will be saying that. This is not going to change. More people are going to be killed. Why? Because this was politicized. It became politicized in the wrong way. And America lacks the leader who would tell both sides that this is not what is in the Constitution.
Is there any chance, do you think, Xenia, of an American president ever confronting this? Because I guess the thing is, if you did, you have to factor in the fact that there's already 300 million guns at large in America, which are never coming back. And plus, this would be the only thing you got to do with your presidency, wouldn't it? It would suck all the oxygen out of your administration.
Sure. Obama took significant, you know, you'll remember the Newtown, Connecticut.
Indeed.
Where I think 20-odd primary school children were killed in December a couple of years ago. That was a defining moment, and the Obama administration took a hold of this idea and actually really tried to move forward what were quite sensible gun control bills, then less sensible but you know, might have a chance of being supported by the Republicans, and then didn't get anything through. So it's not that leaders haven't tried. It's not that leaders arguably haven't tried the right way. It needs to be a particular leader who does it, and it needs to come from the right. There needs to be a leader from the right in the United States to make the kind of arguments that Oscar's talking about,
from
who can
South.
Then partner with the left, if you will, to actually get something through. But it's the left has been trying that again and again and again, sometimes with, you know, truly great strategies at moments in time where you would have thought that you could make progress, and it hasn't happened.
We should note, of course, that Connecticut did pass laws about kids and machine guns after an 8-year-old killed himself with an Uzi in 2008. And it's probably also worth remembering that in the US this year so far, 45 children have accidentally killed themselves with guns kept in their family home. We'll look now towards South America. Brazil is a little over a month away from a presidential election, the campaigning in which was recently tragically upended by the death of candidate Eduardo Campos in a plane crash. Campos's death has ushered his running mate and former presidential candidate Marina Silva back into the front line. Oscar, how has this changed the tone of the campaign? I mean, it's a bizarre and dramatic event to occur in the middle of a presidential campaign. And of course, Marina Silva was supposed to be on that aeroplane as well.
This was a trigger, but, you know, the trends were there before. We all remember the protests last year and this year. We all remember having the discussion here whether or not during the World Cup we would see a mini revolution exploding. That didn't happen because the Brazil team did abysmally.
Did you think it might actually have been more disruptive if they'd won the thing?
I'm pretty certain of it. But
that's interesting.
But in point of fact, Brazilians, particularly young Brazilians, are just fed up with it in general. Not because of a general irresponsibility in civil society, but rather because they see the Workers' Party as having compromised too much. So that also explains why Marina Silva is seen as more radical than Dilma Rousseff. Remember, she comes from the Socialist Party, to the left of the Workers' Party, but now she's in a very particular alliance, an alliance that even the Social Democrats, the rightist party, are ready to support, only because they want the Workers' Party unseated. So far, we see that for the first round, Dilma Rousseff still has 15 points ahead. But if they both go to a second round, things might change. We have a technical draw so far, but this means that the presidential campaign is going to be a lot more interesting than everybody thought.
Is Silva a dramatically different candidate to Campos?
In many ways, she is. On the one hand, she is seen as a social conservative, in the sense that she comes from a evangelical background. But at the same time, she's a strong environmentalist. She was the environmental secretary of Lula da Silva, and she resigned in protest for what she saw as Dilma's compromising attitude towards big business going into the Amazon. So in that way, she's a very interesting candidate. You have a candidate that might please a social conservative agenda, but also one that people on the left of the Workers' Party see as a worthwhile leader to follow.
Zainia, what would be the view of this from Washington, which has a somewhat uneasy relationship with populist South American left-wingers?
Do they have a view?
America, of course, has a view. It has a view on everything, don't you know? America has kind of looked south with some trepidation over recent years. I mean, there have been all sorts of political challenges when they've looked south. They've seen often in the case of challenges like drugs, et cetera, coming across immigration. So the Americans don't, from a policy perspective, don't tend to look south with great enthusiasm in some respects. So I think, is America going to be watching? Absolutely. Is it going to be supportive of a Rousseff victory versus a Silva victory? I think America is actually going to be ready to work with both sides. I mean, there isn't a strong... My guess is, and this is not an area I spend a lot of time working on, but my guess is there isn't a strong view that one side is going to come out better than the other. Where America really is concerned is on things like economics. And so to the extent that the incumbent, be it one or the other, actually takes a positive economic policy, and to some extent, you know, one has concerns with both, but also potential benefits with both, I think that's what America will largely be looking for, somebody that they can partner with economically and more broadly in terms of leadership in South America.
Just finally on this one, Oscar, Silva won 20% of the vote as the Green candidate in 2010. Can she win this?
I think she can if she runs the proper campaign. But again, the Workers' Party is very strong, particularly in the South. And, Silva doesn't have as much of a following in the South. Her second,
yes,
the vice presidential nominee, comes from the South. So that might do the trick. But still, we have to wait and see.
Okay, well, finally to Argentina, where members of the trade union, the General Confederation of Labour, are on a 36-hour strike, which has affected most forms of transport, as well as bars and restaurants, etc. Oscar, they want higher salaries and tax cuts, as do we all, but do they have a case?
I want them. Sena was saying that she wouldn't want to have Obama's job. Well, I think the same can be said of Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner. She's having the worst time of her life. On the one hand, the sword of Damocles produced by the U.S. Supreme Court is hanging upon her, which is, I have to say, very unfair. That was bad law, and we need to say that. On the other hand, the government has behaved in a way that is provocative. It's provocative not only of foreign investors, but also of former supporters. And this is the case in point. You have a workers' movement that, of course, is divided between supporters of Kirchnerismo and non-supporters. But in this case, we have what seems to be a more general case of people reacting to bad economic prospects. And the reaction from the government has not been perhaps the best. I mean, I have heard terms such as authoritarian. Well, you know, you cannot call if you're a government from the left, you cannot call a unions movement authoritarian because they protest in the streets. So difficult situation, no doubt about it. What lies ahead is negotiation in both cases, both with the foreign investors, and I do not share the side of the Volcker funds on this one, I have to say. On the other hand, with the people in Argentina who need support. I'm also certain that Mercosur is going to play a role here.
Okay, coming up for 18:30 in London, we will have to leave it there. Oscar Guardiola Rivera from Birkbeck University, Zainia Wickett from Chatham House, thank you both very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. To vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And there's plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll be hearing from our woman in Brussels. We will pay tribute to the late and great Simin Babahani. And we'll review the latest books, including the latest from Martin Amis. Before we get started on all that, Bill Bingham has the world news headlines.
The top story is Ukrainian officials say two columns of Russian tanks and military vehicles have fired at a border post before entering the southeast of the country. It's reported the tanks entered an area of the eastern Donetsk region seized by separatists for the first time earlier this week. Russia denies its forces have crossed Ukraine's border. UN Security Council members have been told life for Syria's civilians over the past few months has grown worse. Figures quoted by the UN Office for Humanitarian Affairs show more than 191,000 people have been killed between the onset of the conflict in spring 2011 and April 2014. It's believed the real death toll is much higher. The World Health Organization says the deadly Ebola outbreak in West Africa could infect more than 20,000 people before it's brought under control. WHO says the number of cases could already be four times higher than the 3,000 currently registered. And UN officials say 43 of their peacekeepers are being held by an armed group in the Syrian Golan Heights. The UN Disengagement Observer Force personnel were detained near Konaitra during fighting between Syrian rebels and government forces. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. It's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today we're going to Brussels, from where I'm joined by Charlotte McDonald-Gibson. Charlotte, welcome to the show. There's a touch of deja vu about this first story, in which we see the UK's Prime Minister David Cameron inserting himself forcibly into a row over who's going to get a top EU position. It worked out badly for him last time. Why is he doing this again?
Well, that's right. He didn't really have much success trying to block Jean-Claude Juncker from the President of the European Commission post, which is basically the most powerful post in the EU. But it looks like he's going to have a bit more luck getting his man or woman into the post of President of the European Council. This is the individual that puts together these European Council meetings. He is the go-between, the consensus builder between the 28 European nations. So as Britain tries to renegotiate its membership of the European Union, it really is crucial that they have a figure who is sympathetic to the very specific British concerns when it comes to EU membership. And at the moment, it looks like they may have found that person in the current Polish Prime Minister, Donald Tusk. He's the current favourite to get this position when the 28 EU leaders meet on Saturday. And if he does, David Cameron will certainly be happy about that.
Why is David Cameron once again getting so invested in this, though? Because I think, as we discussed last time we were talking about one of these rows, these people who occupy these EU positions, who could walk down any street in the United Kingdom without anybody even knowing who they are.
Yes, that's right. I think people, the average citizen on the street in the UK, doesn't really know what the President of the European Council, the President of the European Commission, what they do, what the difference is between them, or even that they're different people. But it is important to David Cameron and his renegotiation of British membership of the EU ahead of the referendum on Britain's membership in 2017. So it really is crucial that he does find someone there who will give him a sympathetic ear. Jean-Claude Juncker, whose nomination he tried to block at the Commission, he's unlikely to be particularly sympathetic considering their background. So, yes, it really is quite crucial that he gets an ally in this second position.
Is there an element here as well of Britain trying to mend fences to an extent with Poland? Because David Cameron is also in the invidious position as a Conservative Prime Minister, being obliged to keep the crankier fringes of his party happy, as well as Britain's more rabid right-wing press, by occasionally beating up on immigrants, which in Britain in the last few years means beating up implicitly on hundreds of thousands of mostly extremely hard-working Polish people.
Yeah, yes, that's an interesting aspect of Donald Tusk as the front runner. Certainly, David Cameron has, and his party, and certainly some more fringe elements in his party, have not been particularly kind towards the Eastern European migrants over the past year. But at the end of the day, I think David Cameron realises the important economic role that migrants play in Britain. I think Donald Tusk at the same time understands the political concerns that David Cameron has to deal with. So despite the rhetoric we sometimes hear from the UK, Cameron and Tusk do have quite a good working relationship.
Okay, well, there's another aspect of the allocation of top EU positions, which I know you wanted to talk about, and that is that they there's a certain lack of diversity at the top EU table.
It is a little testosterone heavy at the moment, that's correct. Basically, the European Commission is 28 posts. It's like Jean-Claude Juncker's cabinet, essentially, with posts from everything ranging from fisheries to internal markets. So of these 28 posts, each member state gets one post. In the last European Commission of José Manuel Barroso, there were 9 women. So not exactly great. It's not half, but not too bad, especially seeing as some cabinets in other EU countries have only something like 10% representation of women. So not too bad. But so far, as Jean-Claude Juncker looks to build his cabinet, only 4 women have been put forward so far. And that's really pretty pitiful, considering they represent something like half of the EU's population. So there's a lot of concern at the moment at the top levels of the European Union, in the European Parliament as well, how this is going to look if Jean-Claude Juncker has a cabinet, a commission with only 4 women in it.
But would a greater injection of women at the top of the EU make any difference, do you think, or does anyone think, to the EU's slight, engagement deficit with the public, rather? Because there's an Associated Press report I'm looking at now which does note that, well, it rather deliciously says that Baroness Catherine Ashton, who's the EU's foreign policy chief, is the most recognisable woman among EU officials. Again, she could come to London and sit on the Circle Line all day without anybody having the woolliest idea who she was.
That's true, but I think that in the past commission, some of the women have actually been the most vocal and got some of the most concrete results for the EU. And the EU is obviously an institution that a lot of people think is pretty slow and dull and doesn't really get anything done. But, for instance, the Justice Commissioner, Viviane Reding, she's been really outspoken on the NSA spying allegations in the US. And I think she's made a few headlines. I mean, fair enough, she probably wouldn't necessarily be recognised on the streets of the UK, but certainly in terms of getting in the news, she's done a very good job. So the female commissioners in the past commission have certainly earned their stripes, no doubt about it. But I think the point you raised there is quite key. Any way that the EU can find to reconnect with voters who are completely disillusioned with what goes on here in Brussels, they're going to try and find it. And getting more women that represent the population into that commission is one way they're hoping they can do that.
Well, moving seamlessly along on the subject of what goes on there in Brussels, one thing, as I understand it, that people in Brussels are somewhat unhappy about is how long it takes to get anywhere.
Yes, that's right. And there is some connection to the summit on Saturday, because the traffic just gets absolutely dreadful when all the EU leaders come to Brussels. And that's because they close off a load of the roads around the European Union institutions. And that just makes a really bad situation worse. Because every year, the Belgian cities, including Brussels and Antwerp, have voted some of the most congested, not just in Europe, but in the entire world. I mean, they're ranked up there with places like Bangkok, which is really quite unusual when you think of you know, Northern Europe and the love of bicycles and the flat countryside. But, you know, that can apply to the Netherlands, but it's not like that in Belgium. It's pretty bad, and they're really desperate to find a solution, because people can spend up to 85, they spend an average of 85 hours in a traffic jam each year, so no one's really very happy about that.
I mean, that will come as a considerable surprise, I think, to a lot of people, because if you visit Brussels and Antwerp, either because you're working there or as a tourist, and I visited Brussels in both those capacities, if you just stick to downtown Brussels, it does come across as you say, a very quiet, very uncluttered, extremely walkable, pedestrian-friendly city in which it's not terribly hard to get anywhere at all, rather. Why is there that disconnect between that experience and the experience of people who live there?
Well, if you look at the very centre of Brussels, it really is pretty tiny, and those pedestrianised roads which the tourists wander on is just a very small proportion of the city. The big problem with Brussels is most people who work in Brussels don't live in Brussels. So Brussels has a population of around 1.2 million, but that swells to around 2 million each day as all the commuters get in their cars and drive into Brussels. So that creates these huge traffic jams on the ring roads and the roads coming into Brussels. And there's various reasons for that, including that the countryside is ideal for driving, that the company cars are very popular here, and it just doesn't look like it's set to change. There are initiatives that have been raised, such as a congestion zone like London, but they really don't go down very well with Belgians, who are really struggling to wean themselves off their cars.
Charlotte McDonald-Gibson, in the interests of getting you home before midnight, I'll let you go now. Thank you very much for joining us. That was Charlotte McDonald-Gibson, our correspondent in Brussels. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Should cities ban the car? Can we make truly sustainable metropolises? What happens if neighbourhoods lose their corner shops? How do you put a stop to suburban decay? Do children belong in big bad capitals? Can Detroit be saved? Can Sydney become a cycle capital? Can we learn to love concrete? And are rich cities always boring? If you want the answers to the big questions facing our cities, you need to tune in to The Urbanist, Monocle 24 Radio's weekly show about the cities we live in. Expect global reports, great interviews, passionate debate, and some surprises too, because dragstar taxi drivers, love motel owners, and retail rebels also get their say. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 hours London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. It's 1842, near enough here in London. Now, it's not every poet who can command a crowd of thousands at their funeral, and perhaps not every city whose people would turn out in those numbers to farewell a poet. But Tehran's streets were slightly more choked than usual last week as citizens turned out in tribute to Simin Babahani, who died aged 87. Twice nominated for the Nobel Prize in Literature, she was also a prominent activist for women's rights in the Islamic Republic. Joining me now in the studio to discuss her life and work is Fatima Shams, who teaches Persian language and literature at Oxford University. Thanks very much for joining us. First of all, I guess a bit of background for people who may not be familiar with her work. Why was she so important to Iran?
Well, thank you very much for having me in here. Simin Behbahani was one of the most prominent poets of the contemporary Persian literature, not just because of her poetry, but because she was an iconic figure. In the Persian literature, in the tradition of Persian literature, and also in the women's movement in Iran, she was very much active during her life through her verse and through her presence in most of the demonstrations that were happening at the time in Iran with the feminists who were against the compulsory hijab, for instance, or who were up for their civil rights. Simine Behbahani was always present there with her verse, with her poetry, and that made her an iconoclast, if you like. And in that sense, when she died, obviously her poetry was very much favored and welcome, and also read extensively by the Iranian youth and also the older generation. And as well as her poetry, her character was very unique, and in a sense she had no counterpart that we can compare to. And in that sense, she was quite important.
There was one poem in particular that I know you wanted to discuss, which later became a song, which we will play some of shortly. But could you introduce, I guess, the poem and the song and explain how one became the other?
Yeah. One of the, just going back to your question and also talking about this song, I need to also mention that Simin was not just a poet, as I said, and an activist. She was actually a songwriter as well. She wrote more than 100 songs during her life. Some of these songs became quite well-known and important and influential in the course of the revolution and also after the revolution. One of the songs was the one that you just asked about. And she wrote it right after the war. When the 8 years of war between Iran and Iraq in 1980-1988 finished, and the country was thirsty for hope and reconstruction, she gave hope to the new generation, to the youth who were trying to rebuild the country again through her verse. And she wrote this poem. And actually, in one of the interviews, she mentions in details the story behind this verse, that when she comes back to her house once and see all the ruins and the destroyed city, and she asks herself that, okay, what is going to happen next? There is no way but to build the country again. And then she starts writing the poem. And the first bit of the poem, she says, my country, I will build you again. And then she asks herself, but how am I going to build you again? And then she goes that, if need be, with bricks made of my life. And then she goes on and on. She talks about her bones. She talks about the most, you know, bodily parts of a human life in her poetry. And then it was made to a song by one of the most popular Iranian singers, who actually was exiled after the revolution outside Iran, Dariush Iqbali. And the significance of the song was not just because the poem was on itself beautiful and politically and socially important, but also because it was recited again and again in presidential campaigns of the reformists with the young generation, the generation that never saw and witnessed what happened before the revolution. Most of them were raised and born during the war, and still the poem made sense to them. And in that sense, I think the poem is very influential and important, and so is the song.
Okay, we can play the song now. What's the title of it?
The title of it in Persian is Dobare Misazamat Vatan, and in English is My Country, I Will Build You Again.
Dobare Misazamat Vatan اگرچه با خشت جان خیش ستون به سقف تو میزنم اگرچه با استخوان خیش دوباره میبویم از تو گل
So Dariush Iqbali sings Simin Behbahani, who died last week, aged 87. Over the next, I guess, little while in Iran, I know predicting the future in Iran is traditionally extremely difficult. What is her legacy likely to be? What influence will she have?
Well, I think the fact that Simin was quite well read and also was an expert of the classical Persian literature, and she stayed linked to it until the very end of her life, will have a very important influence on the generations to come. Most of the young generation of the Iranian, you know, the Iranian poets are following and reading her work. And she was one of the revivers of the most important traditional form of poetry in Persian, which is ghazal or the sonnets. And in that sense, in terms of content and in terms of rhythm, she made new discoveries in this specific genre. And I think that is quite important for the generations to come to stay linked to their tradition. In terms of literature and also in terms of the importance of such iconic figures in the Persian literature.
Fatima Shams from Oxford University, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. It's 1849 in London. Time now for a bit of music here on Midori House. We will shortly be discussing the week's new book releases. Here is a crashingly obvious fanfare to that. Elvis Costello and the Attractions from their weird 1983 Philadelphia Soul Digression, Punch the Clock. And we played that because we are coming up to the part of Midori House in which we have a look at some or other aspect of the arts and culture, etc. It being, what day is it today? Thursday, all day. It's usually the day we look at books, and today we're joined once again by Kathy Rensenbrink, Associate Editor at The Bookseller, Director of Quick Reads. We're going to start with one of, in fact, in this day and age, arguably the British literary heavyweight, Martin Amis. Whenever Martin Amis puts a new book out, I'm always reminded of the very similar tone in the coverage to when Prince puts a new album out. Everybody wants to call it a return to form. So the dread phrase. In Prince's case, they're covering up for the fact that he hasn't made a decent record since Sign of the Times. Actually, no, that's not fair. Love Sexy. And probably won't again. Martin Amis's new one, The Zone of Interest. Up there?
Yes, I think so. And I know exactly what you mean. There was the similar discussion because his last novel, Lionel Asbo, was bizarre.
I got three pages into it. What it actually read like was Craig Brown in Private Eye doing a yes. Martin Amis thing.
Yeah. So I wondered about this one, but I think it's sort of oddly brilliant. It's a very, very strange and peculiar book. I almost didn't bring it precisely because I find it difficult to communicate what I think about it. But then I thought, no, I should admit that to your listeners because it's, I think part of what he's saying, because it's set in a sort of alternative fictional Auschwitz, I think part of what he's saying is that it is impossible to understand certain things. So that the peculiarness of the book is part of the oddness and the impossibility of ever grasping that period of history.
Because he's been here before, as it were. He has a recurring preoccupation with the Holocaust. Time's Arrow was set in a similar context. Once you run up against something, and he has written very good essays around this subject about the rank inexplicability of this period. Once you've decided something is inexplicable, how do you expound upon it at book length?
Carry on trying to explain it. Yes, I mean, that's why it's a very odd thing. I think some of the things he captures very well is the sort of the banality, the middle management hideousness that must have existed there, as it exists probably in all sorts of organisations. It's almost like he describes the sort of the organisational dysfunction in a way that is, I think, unusual, because I'd never particularly occurred to me before. The characters are all sort of misfits, peculiar. The commandant is a drunk. One of the other narrators is a womanizer in love with the commandant's wife. And somehow, I think, by looking at the sort of the minutiae, the day-to-day nonsense that people would have been involved with, he does seem to succeed in saying something slightly new.
I mean, the banality of evil, of course, was Hannah Arendt's famous coinage, I think, at the trial of Adolf Eichmann. But it's true when you think about it, all that bureaucracy must have existed. I remember there was a case a few years ago when there were intercepted Al-Qaeda emails, but they were bitching about receipts.
That's
and expenses
right, and expense claims. Yes. And there is something quite powerful in realising that, isn't it? I'm not quite sure what it says, but it seems to say something. I've been rereading his memoir recently, Experience, and again, that's interesting because he talks about the subject again. So it's interesting to see how it's a preoccupation for him.
But is this up there in the canon of Amos before we move along to others?
I think it's very well worth a look and probably the best thing he's written in years, definitely.
OK, well, let's move along now to Sarah Waters, The Paying Guests.
Oh, and this is right up there because she is an amazing writer. And this is, I think, I always say I can never really know how good I think something is until about 2 years have passed. And I've been able to compost it. But I think this is possibly my favourite of all her very, very good novels. So this is The Paying Guests. It's set immediately after in the early 1920s, after the First World War. It's a period of austerity. The men are all dead and injured. Our characters, Frances and her mother, are sort of gentry fallen on hard times. They don't have any money anymore and they have to take in lodgers to make ends meet. There's all sorts of secrecy, things unsaid. At one point when Frances's mother is escorted home by a friend, Frances is laying the fire and the mother says, why are you doing that? Because they have to pretend that they still have a servant. So there's all these levels of pretense. The lodgers are called Lillian and Leonard and they're from the clerk class. They're a bit common. And when they agree to take them in as lodgers, they don't seem that bad. But somehow when they come to move in, they're revealed in their full commonness.
Finally, and annoyingly briefly, we do have to move along to Nina Stibbe's Man at the Helm. Nina Stibbe, author of the surprise hit Love, Nina. Is this another surprise hit?
This is just completely brilliant. And I'm in love with this author to a near stalker-like level, I think. both books absolutely full of joy, of wit and charm. There's quite and this one is about a family who end up in a small and hostile Leicestershire village being quite badly treated by people who clearly think that because the mother is newly divorced, she'll be evil and on the catch. And of course, she is going to turn out to be on the catch because her daughters realise that life without Man at the Helm is no good. So they set out to find one.
That's Man at the Helm by Nina Stibbe, enthusiastically recommended by Cathy Rensenbrink. Thank you very much for joining us. That is all we have time for on today's Midori House. I'm repeating myself already. My thanks in particular to our earlier special guests, Xenia Wickett and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. Today's show was produced by Isabel Kayser, researched by David Pleasant and Matilda Ivy. Our studio manager was Chad Chilvers. Andrew Tuck follows this with The Urbanist at 7 p.m. At 2200, Emma Nelson and Nancy Durham are here for the Monocle Daily. This show returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time, hosted by me. Again, you lucky people. But for this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye and thanks for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.